Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community.
One thing I went so far to say, try to imagine. No heaven, no hell, and no God. No king, no country, not even possessions. We all thought he was asking a lie. So we kept on fighting for all of this stuff. But it never turned out to be reason enough to justify losing people we love. Yeah, that's what we did before the end of war. The end of war.
Peace Talk is a monthly program produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It's VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak. Tonight on Peace Talk, we'll have some local news, and later, Varkas Kasuni will be joining us in the second half of the show. He'll be talking about the Armenian Genocide, which occurred 100 years ago, and will share his views on how it's relevant today, especially in light of the refugee situation stemming from the endless wars in the Middle East. Kas, as he goes by, is an Armenian descendant who grew up on Cyprus Island and came to the U.S. where he studied theology and was ordained as a minister in several churches, including the First Armenian Presbyterian Church and the United Armenian Congregational Church. He'll also be speaking in Juneau this weekend, first about the crisis in the Middle East from an Armenian Christian perspective. His second talk is entitled, What Does Our Collective Faith Call us to Do? Can Juneau Sponsor Refugees? And tonight he'll be giving more of an abbreviated introductory sort of talk about both of these topics. But let's start with the recap of the Growing Peace dedication ceremony held in Juneau last month. Growing Peace is the name of the Jim Fowler sculpture installed at the Bishop Michael H. Kenney Memorial Peace Park. The project was spearheaded by VFP and funded by generous donations from many community members, and those were eventually matched by a grant from the Rasmussen Foundation. It is a true peace memorial, which is a relative rarity around the world. We have far more monuments to war than to peace, and even the majority of the peace memorials that have been built are either in recognition of the end of a war or the sacrifices of soldiers during a war. Few are dedicated to peace activists who dare to stand before the swords of nationalistic militarism and the disease of war it has spread across the globe. For instance, there is a peace memorial on the most distant and remote island in the Alaska's Aleutian Chain. The peace memorial at Attu was erected by the Japanese with U.S. permission after World War II. Its inscription reads, "In memory of all those who sacrificed their lives in the islands and the seas of the North Pacific during World War II, and in dedication to world peace." And the U.S. erects them too. There are many like the Josephine County Peace Memorial in Oregon, which honors the men and women who served their country in wars during the 20th century, remembers the wounded, disabled, and missing in action, and then lists all those who lost their lives. It's more like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in D.C. than a true peace memorial. But in Juneau now, we have a peace park named after a longtime peace activist who resided here. And we now have Growing Peace, a sculpture which can only be imagined as a symbol of peace, justice, and equality. For those listeners who may not have the opportunity or may not have had the opportunity to actually see the sculpture, you can find photos of it by using the image search on Google. Just type Growing Peace between quotation marks and add Jim Fowler's name. Yesterday, I discussed the project with Jim and VFP President Phil Smith, and Phil begins explaining the long process from naming the park through to last month's dedication ceremony.
In 2005, the city decided to upgrade the infrastructure on Seward Street, all the way from Front Street all the way up to the Capitol and beyond. And as part of that, they removed the old log cabin that had been put there because the cabin itself was getting rotten and falling apart. And they basically purchased a package of a little park design. And in the middle of all of that, Don Birdseye, excuse me, recommended that the city create a park there, that we call it a peace park. After doing a little bit of research, we found that we couldn't name a park peace. Parks in Juneau are named for people. And many of us who have lived here for a while remember with great fondness the late Bishop Michael Kenney. And Michael died unexpectedly and tragically and way too young in 1995. And he lingered in many of our hearts as a guy that just had a wonderful sense of calm and peace and joy about him. He was a peace activist. He was in a protest at the Trident submarine base outside of Seattle when he held up a sign suggesting that we shouldn't really be naming military ships after places we love. This was an attempt to conferred the name Alaska on one of the Trident subs. Anyway, so everybody thought, well, that's a grand idea. We made a proposal and went to the Parks and Recreation Board, who have been very, very supportive of the whole concept from the beginning. That went to the Assembly and was accepted unanimously. And so then we thought a little bit more about what should we do next. And that's where Jim Fowler came in. We went to Jim, who's a longtime friend and a peace activist himself. Jim designed what is now that sculpture. And we tried very hard to get it funded. And it took us a while. We finally nickeled and dimed all the people in Juneau to get this thing built, and it wasn't a huge amount of money. But, you know, we didn't have any appropriation or anything like that. And this spring, we finally put together all the nickels and dimes and went to the Rasmussen Foundation in Anchorage. And they agreed to supply, I think, $10,000 toward the effort to get the thing fabricated and installed at that park. Just over a week or so ago, almost a month now, we had a little ceremony with great speakers, and the city is now the proud owner of an original Jim Fowler sculpture. And we are considering ourselves as the proud sponsors.
Jim, tell us what your inspiration was for that design and how many other ideas you may have had before you settled on it.
Well, coming up with an image for peace wasn't a clear trail. And I think a lot of my early thoughts revolved around something growing, but I was thinking more in terms of flowers but just making it more of an ornamental sculpture as opposed to something directly related to peace. And but as time went on, some of my friends found out I was working on this, Charles Rohrbacher, and we were talking about it, and so he said, well, this is a Jim Fowler, so I'm assuming there's going to be a lot of color. Well, I hadn't really been thinking about something with a lot of color, but at that point, I really shifted. And so Phil was checking in with me every once in a while to make sure I was still working on this, and I was really having a difficult time coming up with something. And I was kind of going through some of my kids' schoolwork. My kids are now grown, and I came across a little class project from either kindergarten or first grade. And the drawings in it all seem to be around the subject of behavior, personal behavior. And one of the drawings this kind of a large figure with arms extended and a little narrative at the bottom connected to the drawing that said, "Don't hit." And it seemed like just a pretty easy-to-read, direct, elegant idea. So I borrowed this child's concept and came up with this figure. And then I was having trouble with the don't hit part, how to accomplish that. And I was talking to another friend. Or I had a model. I'm talking to another friend. I had a drawings, Ken Melville, and was trying to pick his brain. And then at some point he just said, does it need to be in there? And that seemed, once again, to be the logical answer. And that from that I added the hoe and the slice of bread, and the connection being that a definition of peace is that every child should have at least a chance to have a childhood where they are nourished and loved by adults who can expect to feed them and nurture their growth without fear of outside politics or whatever. And so anyway, that was kind of the path that this took.
And who did you present that to when you finished? Did it go directly to Phil? Did you have your own little committee before you were ready to share it?
I built, after I got those other little details kind of worked out, I built a wooden model. And then I think it was early in 2010, I believe, that we had pulled some tables together at the Rookery and drank coffee, and I showed them the model, and they were real enthusiastic about the direction it was going, and so I was happy, and it just kind of took off from there.
Well, now art has the tendency to really bring people joy, and other people find certain art not to be to their liking, especially public art's always criticized for that. Phil, what kind of process did VFP go through to share that idea before it became the final? And did anybody have any objections to it that made you think twice?
No, which was wonderful. We looked at it, most of us were charmed, and at the model that Jim had come up with, and we were thinking, God, that's just going to be really neat in this little pocket park downtown. And I, for one, and I don't know anybody who didn't, really like it. Just a minute or two after you looked at it, the first thought, you shook your head and said, whoa, what's this? But the colors and the shapes and the expressions and the joy, and I've been watching the Pope this week, so it reminded me the Pope's message of peace, inner peace, as well as, laying down the arms on the battlefield, peace and joy. And I think, this is a personal art critic, that Jim's piece has captured that perfectly. When we first showed up on Facebook after it was installed, there were, notes and people commenting on it. And one person who's very close to me said, wow, with two exclamation marks, and then joy was the word, and three exclamation marks. So I felt that it actually done more than we or I had thought that it might do. We thought it'd be a great place to go and talk about how great it would be if we would get Russia out of the Ukraine, or, people in Congress to quit voting for the militarism in our country. And it is that. But it is also, I think, speaks very personally to humanity. And it's not a Democrat sculpture. It's not a Republican sculpture. So I think Juno is a richer place because of it. And this is the best time I can think of to really thank Jim for his vision and his capable leadership of getting that work installed. Now, we had a lot of members who, one of them is Don Gottschall, who managed to work with the city to get the hole dug, to get the concrete poured, and things like that. But this was really an act of love from a lot of veterans and a lot of others here in Juneau. And we're very proud of it and very pleased to know that it's up and it will shed the rain.
So we've got the installation that just happened, and we dedicated it, and we have the design, and in between is the fabrication. Where did that happen, and who oversaw that, and how did it happen? What was involved in all that?
Well, over the years, I made some, like, 3 trips to Anchorage, and we found finally found a place called Trijet in Wasilla, or no, in Palmer. I'm sorry, and they had a manager named Brian Benston, who got very excited about this project. And so as soon as we settled on them and got things going, the company started having some problems. So Brian just really went beyond the call to kind of keep this project moving along. It slowed down some, but it was really done in a pretty timely manner. So we had computer images made from the drawings, and that was all transmitted through the internet, and is programmed into their water jet cutters, and then there's a process called powder coating, and it's just a very durable bake in color. So the whole thing is all of the aluminum is enclosed in a coating of this, and then the color is added on top. That was another thing. Early on, I was talking to Bob Banghart at a Christmas party, and I had been thinking about steel, colored steel, and he strongly advocated changing it to aluminum since we lived in a rainforest, and that seemed to be a good suggestion.
Yeah, aluminum should be more corrosion resistant.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's made of a half inch aluminum. So it's
half inch thick.
It's half inch thick, and in the design, it's put in pieces. So theoretically, if weather or just physical damage happens, the damaged pieces can be shipped back alone without having to take the expense of shipping the whole sculpture back and forth.
So we went from 2010 to 2015, essentially, once we had a design to completion. When was the original dedication of the park?
That was in 2012, I think, 3 years ago, when on International Peace Day, in September 21 or 22. It's about 3 years ago this week. And it was, as you know, dedicated to the Bishop Michael Kenney, and I believe in my soul that Michael Kenney is enjoying this sculpture very much.
And is there anything left to do on the project?
Yes, there's a little plaque that I need to arrange with the sign people, and that will sort of be the interpretive plaque for the sculpture. We have one for the park. And the plan is to match it symmetrically on the other side as you walk up toward the back, toward the sculpture. You'll see to your left why the park is named for Bishop Kenney, and you'll see to your right this information about the sculpture itself.
So any thoughts of getting it added to the maps for the tourists to find?
Not as a promotion. I know it's noticed, and it'll probably be popping up there. I expect in a few years it'll be a destination in downtown Juneau. It's a place that people will go and have their photo taken. That would be our hope.
Anything else you can add, Jim?
No, I just, you know, I kind of got the showy part of this project, that it's the Vets for Peace that came up with the idea, and they were very patient with me coming up with a design and then getting it put together, and then coming up with the money it may not have been that much money, but it still took some effort to pull together. So I think of it as our sculpture, not mine's.
Great. Well, thank you both. I think it's a great addition to the city, and I hope people enjoy it for generations. That was Phil Smith and Jim Fowler discussing Jim's Growing Peace sculpture that is now standing over the Bishop Michael H. Kenney Memorial Peace Park in downtown Juneau. And at this time, I want to take I want to remember John Simons, a longtime Junoite and one of the original members of Veterans for Peace in Juneau, who passed away earlier this month. Here is Phil Smith again explaining how VFP intends to honor John.
At our last meeting, just last Saturday, we kicked around the idea of naming the scholarship fund at Veterans for Peace after John Simons. Amidst all the pleasure that we have been enjoying, and the pride and the joy by completing the Bishop Kenney Peace Park, we were visited with very sad news on the 5th of September. And that news was that our friend and member and peace activist and teacher and lover of children and peace gently passed away in Portland undergoing treatment for leukemia. And the silence that his absence leaves behind has moved all of us, and has John was an extraordinary man. He was an educator. He was a veteran. He was a principal. He was a very gentle and loving and caring person. John Simons came to Juneau in 1972 with his wife, Annie, who was for years the librarian at JDHS. John was an educator, special education principal, and he worked in the schools until about 1990, I believe. And it just remained a presence. He was, when we got Veterans for Peace local chapter going forward in 2003, he was one of the first members to be a part of it. He was already a member at the national level. And he and John Dunker and myself, many others, but we joined Veterans for Peace. We talked it up. We got people to show up. We got a charter from the national office. And John was instrumental and helpful in all of those things. Over time, he lived here. He had moved to Oregon a few years ago to deal with his illness. The breadth of John's commitments also included the artistic, beautiful, and peaceful place called the Japanese Peace Garden in Portland, to which he dedicated a lot of his time and, I presume, his contributions. And he was just a wonderful man. And we think it's entirely appropriate to have a scholarship going to young people with John's name on it. As an educator, I'll give you one example of the type of man he was. About 3 or 4 years ago, my wife, Deborah, and other friends were traveling, and we had this big plan going as to how we were going to go to Moscow and then take the train across Asia. And so we did. And Moscow at the time were John and Ann Simons, who were living there, because Ann was the librarian for the Anglo-American school, both in Moscow and in St. Petersburg. And they were extraordinary hosts. I mean, it's just wonderful to spend time with them. We went to the flea market. We went to the Kremlin. And I think one of the most memorable parts of it was when we were getting ready to get on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. John handed me a little glassine envelope with 50 peace cranes in it that he had personally folded. They were, you know, 2 or 3 inches. They weren't big ones. They were little guys. And he was so moved by that whole story of the Hiroshima and the peace cranes, and he had visited there, and he handed this little bag to me and asked me, he says, you know, when you're around, when you're going out east, you're going over to the eastern side of Asia, and then, you know, you're going into China and so forth. He said, just leave some of these behind. And so I did. We left them on the train. We left them with the Terracotta Warriors in China. We left them on the Great Wall. And we left these on the cruise ship that we ended up taking from Beijing back to Whittier. But I was just thinking, you know, what a gentle person and what a decent, caring person. So John's legacy is, I think, broad, and we can contribute to it by naming a scholarship after him. He will be an enthusiastic supporter from wherever he may be perched. And my understanding is that the family has requested that people who wish to make a memorial in his name could do so to the scholarship fund.
The Gino Vecchiarelli Veterans for Peace has been awarding a $1,000 scholarship to a graduating senior from Southeast Alaska since soon after it was founded in 2003. For the past several years, we've been inviting submissions by eligible students, which is all seniors except sons and daughters of VFP members. You don't have to be the son or daughter of a veteran. But we've been inviting submissions, essay submissions, about the role music has in helping establish a more peaceful world. We ask the students to listen to any peace song or song that opposes an impending or ongoing war and explain in their words what they believe the songwriter was trying to portray to grow the cause of peace and how that particular song may have educated them about the human cost of war. Now, normally we post announcements and bulletins for the competition near the start of the school year. But because we're naming the scholarship after John Simons, we are redesigning the bulletins and the flyers, which means we're going to be getting them to this year's seniors a little bit delayed. But not to worry, submissions won't be due until March. And in the meantime, students can begin scouring the internet for songs to consider writing about or talk to their parents about music from another era that may have made an impression on them. It's never too early to start thinking in terms of peace. And before we get to the second half of our show, I want to play a song from BFP's Wounded Dove CD that was released in 2006. This is Jane Rudenberg singing Peace is Not a Four-Letter Word, a song written by former Junoite Ed Hine, who produced the CD, with Jane Rudenberg also playing the guitar and Pat Henry on the mandolin. Thank you. You're listening to Peace Talk on KTOO in Juneau. I'm Rich Moniak. On the phone with us from Orange County, California, is V. Kas Kasuni. Did I pronounce that right, Kas?
Yeah. Yeah. Fine.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Kas is an
good to be on there with you.
Kas is an Armenian descendant who grew up on Cypress Island and came to the U.S., where he earned a bachelor's degree from Bob Jones University in 1953. A Master's of Divinity from New York Theological Seminary in 1956, and a Doctor of Ministry degree from McCormick Theological Seminary in Illinois in 1991. He is an ordained minister who has served the Armenian community for years on both the East and West Coast as pastor of local parishes and as the moderator of the Armenian Evangelical Union. He is a member of a team that created the Armenian Evangelical Union of North America and a member of the board of directors for the Armenian Missionary Association. Well, first of all, tell us about the Armenian genocide. I mean, if you look up the phrase "never forget" in Wikipedia, it's listed as a commemorative political slogan alongside slavery in America and the Holocaust, and now the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. But it's likely most Americans aren't familiar with the Armenian genocide. Especially compared to these other three tragic stories. Still, the Wiki article goes on to explain that the origin of the word is definitely tied to the systematic and premeditated extermination of the Armenian people in what is now eastern Turkey, but at the time was under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. Tell us what happened.
Well, Armenians have been living in that region for centuries, and they were overrun from time to time by Persians and by Romans and finally by the Ottoman Turks. And they've been living as a minority people in Turkey, seeking to maintain their identity and their religion. However, they were very successful in every way, and they were in the Ottoman Empire, bankers and technicians and the intelligentsia of the country. So when the war broke out, and on the Eastern Front, the Russian army was also fighting under the pretext of preventing Armenians from joining and succeeding in their desire to carve out a piece of that ancient land, just like the Kurds are doing today. Incidentally, that's essentially the same area where the Kurds are in control now. The Turkish government instituted a plan to exterminate the Armenians, first intelligentsia on April 24, 100 years ago, 1915, and then in different phases, they put the plan into action where from scores of towns and villages, the people were taken out and forced to go on a march toward the Syrian deserts. Many died, of course, on the way, and a few hundred thousand remained. And interestingly enough, they were taken to one of the hot spots of the battles with ISIS today, which is Deir Zor in northern Syria. And they were abandoned there. The remnants who survived were able to continue their life in Syria, and so the Armenian community in Syria today is the growth that has followed the remnants coming together, reestablishing themselves, and after the Ottoman Empire fell after the First War, then Syria became the land where they could prosper. The Arabs were very friendly toward them because they also were fighting the Ottoman Empire at the same time, and so they had a common cause in that regard. And now, strangely enough, the Armenians, as a minority people in Syria, have come under intense attack again because ISIS is a Muslim movement seeking a caliphate in which minorities will be squashed again. And so Armenians have lost their churches, and they have been forced to flee. Quite a few have left already. Just a fraction of the Armenian community is left in Syria. In the northwestern corner of Syria, which is Latakia, on the near coast is the village of Kesab and Kurkune and Ekizoluk. These are ancient Armenian towns, the only ones left from those ancient days. And interestingly enough, the Muslim army came across a Turkish border again and captured and burned these villages until they were again forced out by the Syrian forces. So the Armenian people have sought to have the world recognize the fact that this happened under the cover of the First World War. Now, there were people who were very aware of what was going on and did alert the government. Harry Morgenthau, who was the U.S. ambassador, constantly wrote saying a whole race is being exterminated here, and he even has a book called The Death of a Nation. And others, missionaries, both German and American and English, have their memoirs that we have in which they mention this systematic extermination of the people. What has really rankled the Armenian community for 100 years is that the Ottoman, and of course after the Ottoman, the present Turkish government, has never agreed that this was genocide but just civil war. And to this day, they will oppose any attempt on the part of the U.S. government to recognize this as genocide, and they exert tremendous pressure. They spend millions of dollars in the United States to influence politicians to vote against it when it comes up for consideration in Congress. So essentially, this is what the Armenian Genocide is all about, but it is a festering wound that has never been healed, and it is bleeding again in this day, the body of the Armenian people.
So as I understand, you're saying that the American government has been lobbied or requested to recognize the genocide, but we haven't?
No. The government officially has never passed committee stage to consider a resolution. It has always been stopped because essentially Turkey is an ally of the United States today, and the government does not want to rankle them in any sense and to disturb the alliance that they have. I think that the alliance is a very shallow one, but the American government depends on the Turks, like today, to use their territory to launch their air attacks against ISIS. President Obama, before he was elected, did say that he agreed this was genocide, and that he would work for the adoption of the resolution in that regard. But after he got elected, he always has stopped short of using the term. Interesting enough, he uses a term that the Armenians have used, which is Mezyeren, which is the great tragedy, literally translated. So when he's speaking in English, he uses this term, and nobody knows what he's saying, but won't use the word genocide.
So,
because it's a politically charged term.
Has there been any effort to get recognition for it at the United Nations level?
Well, individual countries have done that, but not on the United Nations level. They have never had that kind of strength to bring it up because the governments that are denying it now hold strong positions like the United States. Interesting enough, even Israel has not accepted the term because, again, for political reasons. And there's a tremendous debate going on among themselves as to why they won't do this now. There are Armenian organizations like the Armenian Assembly, centered in Washington, that constantly work toward that end and have a number of Congress people who are in favor of bringing this up. And they keep working at it. This year, of course, a great impetus was given toward this move because Pope Francis, in a formal high mass in St. Peter's, did come right out and mention this, accepted it, and prayed for the souls of the departed Armenian victims of genocide. And so the whole Roman Catholic Church is on record in that regard. Turkey wasn't happy about it, but they could not do much. So little by little, I think they're slowly going toward in that direction. But the United Nations formally has not adopted or considered adoption of this resolution yet.
So is that how your family wound up on Cyprus Island? Were they fleeing?
Well, yes. Interestingly, many, many people who were able to escape one way or the other made it out. My parents, my father was drafted by the Turkish army before the war had started, and he ended up in the Ottoman army on the Palestinian front, and he was captured by the British, and from then on he was a translator for them. That's how he escaped. My mother, who was a young woman in Marash, you see what happened with the end of the war, that eastern portion of Turkey came under the control of the French, and the French were allies, and Marash was in that region. But then what happened under Kemal Atatürk, the Turks somewhat started or continued their resistance and managed to rally themselves and recaptured that part of Turkey. And that's when my mother, with a whole number of people in the middle of the night in a snowstorm, were able to get out and escape. So everyone has a different story as to how they escaped. Some escaped into what is today Armenia. It was part of the Soviet Union at the time. All the Russian Empire then, under the Bolsheviks, it became part of the Soviet Union. So it is that my people came to Cyprus, and my mom and dad married there, and then I was born on the island of Cyprus. We had a small community of about 5,000 Armenians in Cyprus. Yeah.
And how many of your family members eventually immigrated into the United States?
Well, I had three siblings. We all made it to the United States. And eventually in 1960, I was able to bring my parents over so that they came here and lived their final years in America. And they were living in Fresno, California. That's where they are buried today. And I was there as a pastor, and so I brought them over. I had a sister who stayed in Cyprus, and her husband was of Greek background, and he was a government official with the in charge of the Ministry of Air. And ironically enough, in 1974, when the Turks invaded Cyprus to supposedly prevent the Turkish minority from any injustice under the Greeks, my sister became a refugee because the house she was staying in had to be vacated. So, again, she went through that, but she stayed and her family grew up there. And she just passed away this past March, so I don't have any immediate, except her son and family are still there, one of the sons. Cyprus has been a great place for us all. We had a great upbringing. We grew up in the Second World War years, but the fact that we were never invaded saved us from the kind of suffering other countries underwent. In the Mediterranean, like Greece and Crete and others. And
Well, you know, Americans pay great respect to Holocaust survivors and to children of Holocaust survivors. Do you get the same kind of recognition from people in our country as you discuss this? And again, I don't believe as many people are. Nearly as many people are aware of it, but as you do discuss do you get treated with the same type of respect?
Well, those who know understand, of course, are very sympathetic. Unfortunately, many Americans are not aware. They don't understand even where Armenia is today. It doesn't mean much to them at all. And when the matter comes up, as it did with me on our presbytery floor when I brought the matter for consideration, there were people who got up and they said, you know, Turkey is our ally, 100 years have passed, why bring up old history, and therefore we're not sympathetic. So the Armenians are different from the Jews. The Jews, Holocaust has been, of course, accepted as historically having taken place. Germany has paid reparations. They have their country. There's been a lot of healing going on after that terrible series of events called the Holocaust. But Armenians have never had closure. We have not had psychological closure. And so whenever we have to defend what happened, it brings up the matter. A very painful matter all over again. I have done this personally with people who claim it never happened, that we are exaggerating, etc., but who have not read hardly anything about it. Anybody who cares to, there are voluminous evidence gathered about this event. But, and the fact that 1.5 million Armenians died at the time, there were only about 3 million Armenians in the world. So roughly half the nation perished. So you see how, what a terrible scar that is created in our psyche. And so it is that depending on who it is that you're talking to, they will either say, tell me about it, I never heard about it. There are Turks who never heard about it. And when they hear it and they study it, they become very astonished that this happened in their history. Because in Turkey, officially, this is not taught, and just the opposite is taught, that Armenians in a civil war situation attacked the Turks. So from it varies from people to people as to what kind of response we will get.
Well, in the last 5 minutes we've got, or so we've got here, obviously you mentioned the Armenian people fleeing Syria. They must be a small percentage of the population leaving, but it obviously gives you a personal need to be involved. And I know you're going to be talking about what we can do in our community to help that situation. But why don't you just explain a little bit about how you see the role of the outside world in addressing the current refugee crisis for all people affected by the civil war in Syria?
Well, it's horrible that they say something like 50 million people are on the move as refugees around this world. So the problem is far greater than what's happening in Syria. What happened in Syria is obviously very urgent, and the nations are quite puzzled as to what they can do. I think they're coming across so fast and in such great numbers that they are overwhelming the ability of countries like Italy, for example, to accommodate for their needs. I think that my concern is for those refugees who are coming out who are of Armenian descent. We have our churches there who are in touch with us in this country, who provide special support for them. About 15,000 of them have been already taken into Armenia proper, and quite a few have gone into Lebanon, where they have, as you know, Lebanon has over 1 million refugees from Syria. Those among them who are Armenians are being taken care of by their Armenian compatriots in Lebanon. However, when it comes to the larger picture of all other refugees, their immediate needs should be met. Of course, I think that in this country, we can do quite a bit. We have not done much yet for the Syrian refugees. The possible plans are being suggested that maybe every church in this country adopt a family, a refugee family, to help them come over, to settle down, etc. If that were to happen, I think quite a few could be helped in that regard. In the Presbyterian Church, that's seriously being considered by the leadership. Now, in Europe, what I understand their concern is not only settlement, but what great numbers of refugees coming in will do in terms of tipping the balance, so to speak, of the identity, the religions, and the culture of the people, because those coming in don't want to get assimilated. So here you have large numbers of Muslims now who are clamoring to establish themselves and their religion, and this is creating great turmoil in Europe. I identify with that because I see Islam not only as a military threat, But in terms of its influence in religion in the countries that they settle in, I think the future is going to have
it's going to be difficult. It's a difficult future coming up.
Yes, no doubt.
The future
is going to show that there's more, much more to do. Now, my whole hope and prayer has been that Muslims coming to America will want to be part of the body of people here, and will want to assimilate, not in terms of religion, but in terms of a pacifist religion. Islam, in its form here, will progress to the point where they will obviously give up any desire to use force to advance their cause.
Well, and
that's my hope and prayer.
Yeah, and I think that that's true with most, the vast majority of Muslims living here. And if we can make that point, we would be able to bring some in.
Those Muslims would themselves speak up and work toward that end, I think it would encourage a lot of the rest of us that we should stand with them in solidarity.
Exactly. And I think I want to, we're going to have to call it an evening here, Kas. And
yes.
I know you'll be here this week. I want to encourage listeners to attend one or both talks, the first one on Friday evening, 7 p.m., The Crisis in the Middle East, an Armenian Christian Perspective, and on Saturday at 8 in the morning till 10:30, What Does Our Collective Faith Call Us to Do? Can Juno Sponsor Refugees? Both at Northern Light Church, Northern Light United Church. So with that, I want to thank you, Kas, for joining us tonight. We'll see you this weekend.
Thank you. My pleasure to be on the air with you, and I wish you success in your attempt to use this medium to foster peace among us and in the world.
And I want to also thank Phil Smith and Jim Fowler, who took time out over the weekend to meet with me to discuss the dedication of the Grow in Peace sculpture and the naming of the scholarship in honor of John Simons, who passed away earlier this month. And I want to thank Jeff Brown for being here in the studio with me to do the engineering that we need to have this show done. I hope you tune in again in 3 weeks for another evening of Veterans for Peace sponsored program. I'm Rich Moniak, and have a good night. Did I cut it too short?